A gradual reopening in Texas. The governor promises it will be science-based, but some have questions because of relative low levels of testing. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. How low can you go? What about prices plummeting to negative territory? Understanding the implications of an historic crash in one of the state's staple industries. Fear of an economic impact that could rival the Great Depression in Texas. Street scenes echoing images from the 1930s as thousands of families wait in lines for hours to get food handouts, testing the resources of food banks. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 21st day of April, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. You know, one way to measure the impact of this pandemic on the Lone Star State is to consider how the shutdown is affecting the ability of cities to perform their basic functions. We may have to wait a little while longer to understand the full impact, but this much we know, it is far more serious than most Texans have calculated. Houston's mayor now says his city's budget will take the hardest hit in Houston history and that some municipal employees will have to be furloughed, though we still don't know the scale or scope of those furloughs. Similarly, as we've reported, the economic shock has led to furloughs at some hospitals, threatening the ability of some to stay open, despite the fact that they are badly needed right now. These economic realities have led the governor to move toward trying to reopen parts of the state. Later this week, retail stores will be able to return to business for limited delivery and pickup orders. As KERA's Christopher Connolly reports, the governor says the reopening will be incremental and science-based, but that raises questions about testing.
Abbott said the progress Texas made in slowing the spread of COVID-19 could be quickly reversed if we get too lax about social distancing too fast.
A core component of the ability for Texas to open up our businesses and open up more of our socializing is going to be tied to the increased testing that we will be conducting.
Texas has done a lot of testing for COVID-19, but when it comes to per capita testing, most other states are doing a better job. Abbott didn't say on Friday exactly how much he wants testing to increase, but he said it will.
Well, in the short term, you can continue daily increases with the information that we have about a massive amount of testing capability coming to Texas by late April, early May. It'll be going up quite a bit.
New estimates out this weekend from the Harvard Global Health Institute say the nation as a whole needs to ramp up significantly before reopening the economy. By their recommendations, Texas should be doing at least 44,000 tests per day. Last week, the state averaged about 8,000 tests per day. Put another way, at minimum, Texas has to do five times as many tests each day to meet the Harvard standard. And other public health experts want even higher standards. So, what happens if we do less social distancing, but we don't do more tests?
Let's say, for example, people are starting to move about and somebody does have coronavirus.
Epidemiologist Bijal Balasubramanian is the regional dean of UT Health School of Public Health in Dallas.
When they are not feeling too well, if they cannot quickly get the test that they need, and this person is still out there in the community, they are likely to keep spreading this virus pretty quickly.
She says public health departments also need the capacity to quickly trace that person's contacts, which means an army of people working the phones, calling anyone who may have been exposed, and a good system to share that information, which is no small task.
We will need assistance just like every other state.
That's Aaron Carlson from the UT Arlington School of Nursing and Innovation. Governor Abbott says the vice president assures him the feds will help increase testing capacity, but Carlson says they haven't done a great job so far.
The federal government should have avoided an unfunded mandate in this situation and should provide assistance with testing and contact investigations. Both testing and contact investigations are essential to preventing a resurgence of disease.
Carlson says the governor's data-driven approach to reopening the economy is right, but can only work if he has enough data to drive his decisions in the right direction. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
We should note that late yesterday, the governor announced the mobilization of some 1,200 National Guard troops to operate mobile coronavirus testing sites. The Texas Tribune reports that the first two sites are being set up in Fredericksburg in the Hill Country and another in Floresville, southeast of San Antonio. Some 25 teams will be deployed at locations across the state based on need determination assessments from the Texas Department of State Health Services. It's part of the COVID-19 story we continue to follow here on The Standard. Yesterday marked another first. For the first time, West Texas intermediate oil prices dropped below zero as demand declines around the globe. What does this mean? How did it happen? And what does it add up to for Texas? For all of this, we are joined by energy and environment reporter Mose Bouchel. He's from our home station, KUT. Mose, welcome back.
Hey, David.
I was reading that everyone's watching what's happening with the prices of oil after what seems to be a rather technical issue that happened related to futures prices. These are contracts that people are willing to pay for oil in the future. Could you explain what that's about?
Yeah, and this is kind of tricky for people that aren't kind of in the business to understand. But basically, as you said, futures contracts refer to contracts to deliver oil at some point at a later date. And today is the deadline for oil delivery for May. So as people that were sitting on a lot of oil were coming up against that deadline, one of the things that we think happened is that everyone kind of started to scramble to unload this oil, and that led to this rush to to get rid of it that plummeted prices into negative territory. Now, there's a little bit more to it than that, but that's what people are talking about when they talk about this one kind of technicality.
Okay, so negative territory, it's negative dollars. That's a difficult concept for a lot of people to wrap their head around. But if you're wanting to buy something, typically you're paying out money. In this case, what it is what? That oil companies can't sell their oil. In fact, they have to pay someone to take it. Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Oil companies and other people who might be investors who have a lot of oil that they're trying to get rid of. The easiest way to think about negative pricing is to think, that whoever would typically sell me something, they're now going to pay me to take it.
So if you, you're going to end up with a situation rather quickly if you're paying people to take your oil. You won't have enough places to put that oil.
Right. And I think that is probably what we saw yesterday at play, right? We are running out of storage space. That's not to say there's none left, but there's less and less of it left. And a lot of it that is still available to take oil may be already accounted for. People might already have kind of dibs on that space. So yesterday, there's a lot of speculation that what happened is that people are sitting on a lot of oil, suddenly realize no one wants to buy it, and they don't even have a place to put it. Suddenly, you've got this oil you just got to get rid of, and that could lead you to offer someone money just to take it from you.
Well, let's talk about what the implications are here in Texas and how we got there. Maybe that's a good place to start, because just a few months ago, it was boom times in the oil field in Texas. People were getting hired left and right, and places like Midland, Odessa were in good economic shape. What happened to turn that around?
Well, it was this historic 1-2 punch that we've heard so much about. First, you had the coronavirus hit, and that just cratered demand. No one's going anywhere. No one's getting their car to drive anywhere. People aren't flying. Businesses are shutting down. And so people have a lot less need for oil. And then you also had this kind of price war between other oil-producing countries that really led to an intentional, I guess you could say, oversupply of oil from Saudi Arabia and Russia. You had too much oil and no demand, and suddenly prices tank.
So what does all this mean for Texas? I know there have been a lot of layoffs in West Texas trying to respond to these plummeting oil prices.
Absolutely. You're going to see massive job losses, massive layoffs, and you're also going to see the state budget get hit really hard. The budget takes in billions of dollars in tax revenue from the oil industry, and there's no way that that's not going to be dropping significantly. It really kind of remains to be seen. This is completely uncharted territory. Like you said, negative pricing has never been seen before. Whether this reemerges, in the future, we have to wait and see. These deadlines come along every month, so who knows about that? And also, there's the question of how quickly the industry can respond. Right now, what really needs to happen to stabilize the price is to reduce supply, right? But it's not clear, how we're equipped to do that. And that's actually a debate that's going on right now in Texas.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing that's happening. And again, all of this is uncharted territory, to use your phrase. Later today, the Texas Railroad Commission, which is the regulatory agency that oversees the oil and gas industries in the state, will be meeting amid a lot of talk about the state mandating a cut in production. Has that happened before?
It has, and this is fascinating. The last time this happened in Texas was about 50 years ago.
Wow.
This is the power that the railroad, the Railroad Commission got this power in the 1930s and used it for maybe, for several decades. But once the state of the industry kind of changed to the degree where they didn't think it was necessary anymore, they just stopped even considering limiting production amounts. Now, as it seems, the industry is incapable of kind of ratcheting back production enough on its own. This has come up again. Some companies want the state to come in and intervene. Others are very opposed to it.
Yeah, I guess something that we need to understand here is that the reason that the industry itself isn't stopping production altogether is that there's a sort of a scramble. If you don't have any money, some companies believe it's more important just to get it out there and get whatever little bit they can just to keep alive, right?
Yeah, and you could really almost think of this like a game of chicken, right? Maybe everybody knows that they need to cut back for the good of the industry, but no company wants to be the first one to do it, right? So they kind of make half measures, and that's really part of what's bringing us to where we are.
Add to that list of unprecedented things happening right about now, Mose Bouchel continues to track it. He is a reporter at our home station at KUT in Austin. Mose, thanks so much, and stay safe and healthy.
You too, David. Thank you.
Joining us once again is our, filling in for social media editor Wells Dunbar. It's Michael Marks. Michael, how you holding out?
Pretty good, David. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Just heard Mose break it down for us. Negative territory for some futures prices of West Texas Intermediate. That's going to mean financial pain for a lot of people, not to mention the state budget. Part of this tweet from user Kawan22G6 in Odessa lays out some of the ripple effects pretty well. He says you've got to consider the school districts that depend on the tax revenue, the banks that are dependent on loans, the housing industry that depends on construction contracts. Big ripple effects, you know, also illustrated in this tweet by VJ Burton in Midland. She says she works for an oil company and writes, I've managed to keep my job, but I won't if the price of oil doesn't stabilize. I get that people feel like they shouldn't feel sorry for these oil companies, but I'm a person just like they are, just like all the other people they employ.
Yeah, this is affecting folks even beyond Texas. The Houston Chronicle has a fascinating story on how governments around the world are scrambling for answers over this historic oil collapse. We want to hear what's happening in your part of Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Just a few weeks after taking possession of a closed hospital in Garland, the VA North Texas healthcare system reopened the facility to the surprise of many. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports on the facility's new focused role.
Staffers voiced disbelief with the quick turnaround, which is unprecedented for VA. Crews worked around the clock, installing new machinery, fixing sewer lines, and painting walls.
You can't imagine the amount of work that it took to get all of that established.
LaTanya Aris helps direct patient care services at the Garland site.
It looks like a brand new facility. It is one of the most impressive things that I've seen, and I've worked for the VA almost 22 years.
The 470,000-square-foot facility, which closed its doors in 2018, was donated by Baylor Scott & White in early April. It will eventually serve as an outpatient and specialty care clinic for veterans in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. For now, though, the 207-bed space will act as an overflow center for the Dallas VA, serving patients with less acute medical issues. Aris says the North Texas VA system expects coronavirus cases to peak among its patients by May 23rd, and the site is ready.
I do feel like we're able to handle the surge when it gets here, and we've made all of the provisions and plans to make sure that we can care for all of our veterans that come to us.
The new medical center could be called into action to help non-veterans, too. One of the VA's missions is to serve as a backup for civilian hospitals in times of crisis. I'm Carson Frame reporting for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Over the weekend in Houston, thousands of cars waited in line for hours to get handouts of food. A few days earlier, the lines for food zigzagged across a parking lot in San Antonio. In a land of plenty, sights like these haven't been seen since the Great Depression. With so many Texans out of work due to COVID-19, the Texas Standard's Jill Ament reports Texas food banks are being pushed to the limit.
When stay-at-home orders were issued across Texas late last month, food banks knew they would play some sort of key role for those about to lose their jobs. Little did they know then how quickly their role would grow, seemingly overnight.
So we've never seen anything like it, and it's everywhere. It's hitting every single county of the state. It's hitting every single state in the nation. It's impacting communities everywhere.
That's Celia Cole. She's Chief Executive Officer of Feeding Texas. She says the 21 Texas food banks her nonprofit helps run are seeing a whopping 88% rise in clients statewide. Her network of food banks was distributing 50% more food as of a week ago.
Food banks are doing what they do best, which is they're nimble, they're creative, they're able to shift resources quickly, and I'm really proud of the work that they're doing and how they're responding. But again, I'm hearing all over the state a concern that they could run out of food and not be able to keep up.
Those 21 food banks in Texas also work to serve a network of thousands of food pantries, soup kitchens, churches, and community centers that give food to those in need. But these smaller partners are running out of food. It's estimated some 30% have closed their doors.
West Texas is another example of a food bank that's been hard hit. They got doubly hit because they got hit by the crash in oil and gas prices at the same time. That's another area of the state that is very rural, with big distances between distribution sites, loss of agency partners, lots of volunteers dropping out.
Cole and her team have been trying to get federal or state aid to provide a lifeline for Texas food banks. Stimulus packages approved by the president back in late March cleared $72 million of emergency funding to go to Texas food banks during the COVID-19 pandemic. But that money isn't expected to be distributed until July.
We've been super panicked, and our community has been rallying, and lots of corporations and foundations and individuals all giving financially to help us close that gap.
That's Eric Cooper. He's the president of the San Antonio Food Bank. Cooper says his food bank, along with the West Texas, Houston, and North Texas food banks, put in requests for state aid in early April through Texas's Department of Emergency Management, or TDEM. Cooper says he requested up to $12 million in aid.
And together, we were just trying to inform the governor on really what was happening in Texas cities, and just the fact that Texans are not working. Many of them, their last paycheck dollars were being spent, and now these families don't have food.
Before the stay-at-home orders, San Antonio's food bank served about 60,000 people each week in 16 counties. Now, that number has doubled to 120,000 and includes many first-timers. Cooper says 70% of the people, like hotel workers who have been showing up, haven't had food assistance before. Cooper and several other food banks were told by the state late last week, instead of the money they were seeking, Texas will work to get 44 million pounds of food from the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Cooper says he expects his food bank to get 12% of that food.
It's the extra 60,000 that we're feeding that this extra food will go a long way in making sure all 120,000 people we're feeding each week get access to some healthy food.
A state spokesperson told the Texas Standard that 44 million pounds won't come all at once. It's a 90-day projection of need for Texas food banks. FEMA limits state food bank requests to only a 30-day supply of food at a time. So for now, the state is seeking 14 million pounds to get food banks through the next month. Celia Cole with Feeding Texas says she's grateful for these requests for aid, but it's still not clear when the food will arrive at food banks and just how long it will last under this increased demand.
It's not going to meet all of the need, and we'll continue to push for additional food and resources to ensure that we can serve the people who need our help right now.
Meanwhile, Cole wants Texas to loosen some of its eligibility requirements under the State Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP. Rachel Cooper is a senior policy analyst at the left-leaning Center for Public Policy Priorities. She says a major barrier for Texans trying to access SNAP benefits right now is their eligibility is still based on how much their car is worth or if they have a savings account. Cooper also thinks Texas families with children who typically receive free or reduced lunches at school should be given that money.
Congress authorized that every child who would normally get free or reduced school meals can now get the value of those meals put on a debit card, an EBT card, and sent to their families. You know, Texas hasn't gotten that piece figured out yet, and we're hoping that they move quickly to get that implemented.
State health officials say they're awaiting the U.S. Department of Agriculture to approve their plan to do just that. Celia Cole at Feeding Texas hopes these changes to food assistance programs in Texas comes soon, giving food banks some relief. Reporting in Austin, I'm Jill Ament for the Texas Standard.
An Alaska indigenous group is taking Neiman Marcus to court, suing the Dallas-based luxury retailer for copyright infringement. The item in question is a $2,500 Raven's Tail knit coat. The Sealaska Heritage Institute says that the high-end store copied the traditional Raven's Tail weaving pattern used by Northwest Coast Native tribes, an alleged violation of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act as well as copyright laws. If they plan to collect on their suit, it may turn into a race to the courthouse, as it's been reported Neiman Marcus plans to file for bankruptcy this week, and a bankruptcy could mean settlements of just pennies on the dollar for claimants. It's a story we're tracking here on The Standard. The roundup is next.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Railroad Commission could limit statewide oil production today. The fossil fuel regulators are considering a request to reduce output in response to the U.S. oil market's collapse. On Monday, West Texas Intermediate crude fell below $0 per barrel for the first time in history. In a teleconference this morning, Commissioner Wayne Christian described the impact so far.
According to our primary vision, over the course of the last 5 weeks, the rig count is down 33%. Frac jobs are down 50%. This drop in price and reduction in production unfortunately means harm to Texas jobs and our economy.
The Railroad Commission has not ordered oil production limits since 1973. A Dallas area congressman is one of the latest Democrats to express concerns about reopening the Texas economy without more widespread testing for COVID-19. Colin Allred spoke during a teleconference Monday night.
I do have some concerns about reopening all of our businesses without specific benchmarks and a plan to lead us through this.
Last Friday, Republican Governor Greg Abbott announced a gradual plan to reopen the economy, including allowing for curbside product pickup at all retail stores. A new report from the American Civil Liberties Union finds black people are 2.6 times more likely than white people to be arrested for marijuana possession in Texas, despite nearly equal usage rates. The group examined data between 2010 and 2018. In 2018 alone, arrests for marijuana possession accounted for more than 40% of all drug-related arrests in the state. Nick Hudson is with the ACLU of Texas that's pushing to decriminalize marijuana to reduce the prison population. He says this step is especially important during the current pandemic.
COVID-19 is underscoring the urgency of action to reduce the number of people coming into contact with police and going into jail, particularly for departments and judges and prosecutors who are committed to racial justice.
26 states have either legalized or decriminalized marijuana. And a group of nursing students at the University of Texas at Austin is translating materials on the coronavirus into Spanish and distributing them to communities in the U.S. and Latin America. Doctoral student Daniel Suarez Boquero, who is spearheading the effort, was already a licensed nurse in Colombia. He saw a need for information in his home country and recruited his classmates to translate the Handbook of COVID-19 Prevention and Treatment. Initially, it was only available in English and Mandarin. He says while sometimes the voices of nurses are diminished, he believes nursing can change the world.
And we as nurses, we need to realize that the leadership is fundamental in nursing in order to save lives, to improve healthcare, and to support nursing worldwide.
The handbook is available on the UT School of Nursing website. I'm Joseph Leahy.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Earlier in the show, we discussed yesterday's massive drop in oil prices. Now we're going to be turning to a different bust altogether in the oil industry. This week marks the 10-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. It was one of the worst environmental catastrophes in United States history. On April 20th, an explosion on the offshore rig owned by British Petroleum killed 11 people. If not at that exact moment, then shortly thereafter, the undersea well sprung a leak. It jettisoned oil into the Gulf of Mexico until July 15th, nearly 5 million barrels total, according to estimates from federal regulators. A decade removed, we probably still can't account for all of the spill's long-term effects. But we're going to begin by bringing in Lauren Steffi. He has literally written the book on this subject. He's a writer for Texas Monthly and author of Drowning in Oil, BP and the Reckless Pursuit of Profit. Lauren, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Before jumping into where we are now, let's talk a little bit about the subtitle of the book that you wrote on this topic. It includes the word reckless, reckless pursuit of profit. Tell us a little bit more about how this catastrophe was caused by recklessness.
Well, what you saw with BP during the years leading up to the Macondo disaster was a pattern of behavior where safety and maintenance at different facilities were compromised, usually because of financial concerns or financial pressure. It's important to remember the 11 people who died and the 17 who were injured and, the others who are still struggling, who were on the rig, who are still struggling with the effects of that. And that's something that tends to get lost in all this was, there was a pretty significant loss of life. And so that was really kind of this pattern that you saw. You saw it in their refining operations and you saw it in some of their other offshore operations as well.
Deepwater Horizon oil spill was a huge blow to a lot of coastal communities. I was there when it happened. And yet, you go back a few years later, and it's kind of hard from a distance to tell much has changed from the good old days. I mean, to what extent have these towns and communities along the Gulf Coast been able to recover?
I think it depends on the towns. It depends on the people within the towns. You know, the tourism industry has been able to bounce back because once the oil goes away, obviously once you can't see it, then it's easier for those businesses to recover. Some of the fishermen and the people that relied on the seafood industry, that shutdown was longer and some of the damage was more profound. And there are still companies that either didn't come back or are struggling with, to get back to where they were before the spill.
Well, I remember going to one of these Gulf Coast communities and looking at the new construction and seeing the people on the streets and asking around, and it turned out that a lot of these communities ended up getting lots and lots of money. BP ended up having to pay out billions to compensate victims of the spill, including a lot of communities that suddenly got a kind of windfall. And it led to a kind of a facelift along a lot of the coastline. How far did that money eventually go when it came to repairing some of the damage done?
You know, I always said that for everybody affected by the spill, it was in a weird way, it was fortunate that it was BP that it happened to. You know, a company that had deep financial resources that they could create the funds to help repair the damage. And so, yeah, a lot of communities did get benefits from that. A lot of individuals, a lot of business owners got settlements that really helped out and really did make a difference. And that's been very important. But, it's one of those things. There's still lingering effects that we don't know the full impact of, and that's something the communities will continue to deal with.
Well, I guess another question is 10 years after the fact, is there a lower risk of another Deepwater Horizon? And are oil companies any better prepared to respond?
Yeah, I think that's the big question, and it's one that people both inside and outside of the industry are still wrestling with. We've seen the current administration has made an effort to roll back a lot of the reforms that were put into effect after the spill. But, you know, some of those were more effective than others. And I think that, you know, what we have never really looked at after the Macondo disaster was, are we taking the right approach to regulation? You know, is simply mandating more prescriptive solutions the answer, or do we need a different approach like what they have in Europe?
Are you surprised that BP is still in business? I mean, this was an enormously expensive disaster as well.
It was enormously expensive, and for a while there, it was really touch and go for the company. I mean, their stock price was down. They were really undervalued. There was a lot of speculation they'd be taken over. But, you know, Bob Dudley, to his credit, implemented a process of selling assets and restructuring the company. And, you know, I mean, I think that they had the ability to hold on. And, you know, they're a much smaller company than they were prior to the accident, but they're also a much more focused company now. And, you know, we'll see how things will go for them going forward. I mean, it's a tough time in the oil business. So, they have other challenges ahead of them now.
We'll have more on the 10-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill on tomorrow's broadcast, including the environmental impact. Today, we've been talking with Lauren Steffi. He's a writer for Texas Monthly and the author of Drowning in Oil, BP and the Reckless Pursuit of Profit. Lauren, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
My name is Delia Perez Meyer. I'm a retired teacher and a college professor. But that was 1% of my life. So 99% of my life has been trying to save my brother's life and becoming an activist. I say that I am the sister of an innocent man on death row. His name is Luis Castro Perez, and it's torture for us not being able to see him right now during this pandemic. You know, Luis had a heart attack in November, and then he suffered another heart attack within 2 months of that. You know, I want to know how he's doing. I want someone to go check on him, because for 23 years, we've been able to see him once a week. We've never been able to touch him. So as far as visitation, it takes us 4 hours to get there, and we visit for 2 hours. And then, of course, 4 hours to come home. They bring him shackles and chains, and that's the hardest thing to have to witness. You know, they unlock these steel cages, and they let him in, and he has to turn around and get on his knees because he's very tall, and the little lockbox is very, very short here. And, you know, let them undo his handcuffs. So that is a very painful part, is having to see him in a cage behind the glass window. And then we get a little phone, and then we can speak to each other in these phones. During this pandemic, when everybody has to stay home and everybody's complaining about not being able to go out and not being able to see their families and not being able to do this and that, and I'm thinking to myself, you can call, you can text, you can say hello over the fence to your neighbors, you can Zoom, you can email, you know. They're in isolation. They're in absolute, total isolation. They have no idea what's going on. There are no radios, no cell phones, no televisions. There is nothing for them. These guys on death row, they have a cell, and it is 6 by 9. And that's about, you know, just a few steps for a large person. I mean, my brother can touch the walls with his hands, you know. It's nerve-wracking. I mean, it's, you know, I think about it 24/7. Now, several people are being released. Of course, death row will not be released. And so that's another added trauma for us. You know, it's the same thing when there's a hurricane. Everybody gets released except for death row. What's really interesting right now is that there are no executions. And for those of us that are on the front lines that attend the executions every single week, it's been a blessing. It's a blessing to those who have been
already scheduled for executions. It's a blessing for their attorneys and their families and for us as supporters that we don't have to stand there now every week and weep, you know. So we're in no hurry for the gears to start up again, but they will. But he has been very, very strong. And, you know, we dream that one day he's going to come bounding through that door and that we will get to. I picture it as, you know, our whole family just one big giant hug and him falling to the ground and the kids all over him like they were when they were little, you know. I mean, Lewis has 10 children and grandchildren, and he's never been able to see them, much less be able to hold them and touch them. My name is Delia Perez Meyer, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Forty-four minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. From colorful graffiti parks to a world-class museum district, scores of galleries, and a rich performing arts community, Houston's art scene isn't just strong, it's booming, or we should say it was before this pandemic. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin reports now on efforts to help the city's arts world weather an unprecedented downturn.
Theaters are closed, so are galleries and museums. Art shows are canceled. Houston's Theater Employees Union is reporting close to 100% layoffs. It's a big hit for a city that gets more than $10 million in annual sales tax revenue from the arts and culture industry. The Houston Arts Alliance did a preliminary damage assessment for the arts community. John Abodili is the CEO.
And what we found is that there's at least $50 million in real or anticipated losses.
That includes $35 million in lost earned income. And Abodili says three-quarters of independent art contractors are losing work.
So that would be the artists that are doing shows at museums or performing on stage. About 75% of them are losing their contracts.
Abodili says artists of all kinds are affected, be it in the visual, performing, or literary arts. And it's not just artists, but anybody working in the arts.
Because there are many cultural institutions that are forced to lay off their workforce. So it's both the creative producer types of all disciplines, but also the managers. Institutional managers.
He says some artists are going online to sell their art. But with so much uncertainty, especially in the world's energy capital, buyers are scarce.
We found that because the market is so far down and unstable, and because the value of oil and gas is so far down in Houston's case in particular, that there is not as nearly as much of an exchange of money for artist goods taking place.
And to make matters worse, many artists work on contract and are ineligible for unemployment benefits. There is help, though. The Houston Arts Alliance, together with several other organizations, has launched a relief fund to support Houston's struggling artists. Those who qualify get a $1,000 grant.
And within a week, we had $180,000 in requests.
The money is meant to go toward food and housing. A similar effort is underway for one specific group of artists, musicians.
Music is one of the things that is keeping the world going right now.
Rachel Austin is a marketing professional who works in hospitality, retail, and music.
You know, music is something that connects us all and gives us a layer of emotion in a time where everybody feels very disconnected due to social distancing, and we want to keep music alive.
Her husband, Mark Austin, is a local talent buyer and music manager. Together, they launched the Houston Music Foundation to raise $500 grants for people in the music industry.
Why does this sect of our population not have somebody to support them? If you look in Austin, there's a dozen organizations like this that are all humming, that are in place, that have funds ready to go, are easily able to raise more funds.
More than 10,000 people work in the music industry in Greater Houston, according to the Texas Music Office. About 3,500 of that are working musicians. In just 4 days, the fund received 600 applications from all types of musicians.
You know, what surprised me about it was a lot of the applicants are teachers at, you know, public schools who teach music and have lost income because of the fact that they are no longer offering private lessons.
While $500 may not seem like a lot, Rachel Austin says it helps meet immediate needs for people who don't usually make much more than that.
A lot of these musicians are only making upwards of couple hundred dollars for a performance.
She says the fund is not meant to be long-term support, but emergency relief for a profession that otherwise has few places to turn for help. I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
We're going to be hearing from Michael Marks on the Talk of Texas in just a couple of minutes. We're fast approaching 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last month, as Texas began implementing orders to control COVID-19, the picture on the other side of the border was starkly different. We reported that Mexico appeared largely unaffected. Well, that has changed dramatically. In Ciudad Juarez, across the U.S.-Mexico border from El Paso, COVID-19 is claiming the lives of factory workers. Several employees at a Lear Corporation manufacturing plant have died. Others are sick. KTEP's Angela Cocherga has one family story.
Raul Rosales worked as a quality control supervisor in Ciudad Juarez at a Lear Corporation factory. The company makes automotive seating and electrical systems. His daughter, Monica Rosales, said he spent the last couple of weeks fighting for his life after testing positive for COVID-19.
He's not breathing by himself. He's with a ventilator.
On April 11th, Raul Rosales' family had him transported by ambulance from a medical facility in Juarez to a hospital on the Texas side of the border. He's a legal U.S. permanent resident, and his family lives in El Paso. Monica said her mother and 57-year-old father had exchanged messages saying goodbye as Rosales' condition worsened in Juarez. Monica texted her father emoji hearts and a photo of his grandson.
You know, my baby, he's 14 months old and he loves him. He always laughs with him.
Rosales says her father told her other Lear managers were in the same Juarez hospital. He also texted that he believed the actual number of COVID-19 deaths at his manufacturing plant was much higher than the Mexican government was revealing. We asked Lear about that, and the company declined to provide an exact number of employees who have died. In an emailed statement, Lear said, quote, "We are saddened that several employees at our Juarez City operations who were receiving medical treatment for presumed cases of COVID-19 have passed away due to complications of respiratory illness," end quote. In the same statement, Lear said the company is working to provide the necessary support, including grief counseling and medical care, to the employees' families and coworkers.
Número de personas fallecidas, empleados de maquiladora.
Chihuahua State Health Authorities, during an online press conference Sunday, said they've confirmed 9 deaths of workers at maquiladoras, or factories, in Juarez, and are waiting for medical records for another 4 patients. That would bring the total to 13. It's not clear if all the Lear employees are included in that tally, since the count is of those who've been tested for the virus.
Lo más probable es que sea COVID.
Dr. Arturo Valenzuela, Chihuahua State Health Authority in Juarez, acknowledged that many current cases of pneumonia or severe respiratory illness are probably COVID-19.
Our workers are probably in a death train.
Traveling on a death train is how labor rights activist and attorney Susana Prieto describes the situation for Mexican factory workers. She said those who've lost loved ones on the job because of COVID-19 should demand their companies take responsibility. Raul Rosales's family could not help but think about his years of loyal service to Lear as they anxiously waited for news from the hospital. His daughter said Rosales, like so many in Juarez, was a proud Lear employee. In December, at his wife's 50th birthday dinner, he wore a shirt with the company logo.
He did a lot. He did a lot for Lear Corporation.
Monica announced to family and friends that her father, Raul Rosales, died Tuesday. She posted on social media, "He became an angel this morning." In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us again is Michael Marks, who's monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. What you hearing out there, Michael?
Hey, David. Of particular interest, coming off that story we just heard to folks along the Texas-Mexico border, wanted to bring up this pronouncement from President Trump that came via Twitter about 9 Central last night. I bet you do, too. And he tweeted, "In light of the attack from the invisible enemy," that referring to the coronavirus, "as well as the need to protect the jobs of our great American citizens, I will be signing an executive order to temporarily suspend immigration into the United States." Mm-hmm. Now, details on the scope of this or how exactly the president might do it, those are scant so far, although Politico did report earlier today that the order would likely not include farm workers. Over on the Texas Standard Facebook page, David, Dana Rowan in Fredericksburg has a question about another crucial segment of the workforce.
Uh-huh.
He asks, what about health workers that we need and will need so desperately in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm.
Are there exceptions? So far, no signals from the Trump administration itself about what might be in that order, though.
I'm just going to say it's a little unclear what legal authority the president will claim to shut off immigration. I mean, he said that he has broad health emergency powers to restrict asylum at the southern border. And as we are all aware, the White House has repeatedly attempted to invoke executive powers in immigration law to impose travel bans. Right. So it's really not clear at all what exactly it is that he is going to cite if, in fact, he does move forward. And there's just a lot of ifs here. Right. I mean, we have a tweet. Then that's it.
That's exactly right. And as you mentioned, David, with some of those previous orders, what you saw was a swift response through the court system in order to challenge his authority on that. I think it's safe to presume that you may see something similar should an executive order of this nature be signed. Also on our Facebook page, Linda Pallett sums up the sentiment of most of the comments there. She writes, "President Trump is solving a problem that does not exist. It is too bad he does not try to help with the problems that do exist." That said, you also don't have to look that far on social media to find folks who support the move, in principle, at least.
Mm-hmm.
In Dallas, Chad Michael Murray tweets, "With around 20 million or so folks out of work and rising, the worst in our history, you don't think we should at least consider pausing the immigration of more workers into American jobs? This seems like common sense, or at a minimum, a valid discussion until we're back on our feet." As they say, David, watch this space. Also had some reaction real fast to the story we heard earlier by the Texas Standard's own Jill Ament about the strain that Texas food banks are currently under.
Right.
Story served as a reminder to listeners like Morgan Hamilton that if you can do something, do it. She writes on our wall, "This is exactly why those of us who can afford to make a donation need to do so. Even small donations help. If you're in a position to help a food bank," of course, not everyone is at this time, but there's a lot of folks on Twitter who are talking about donating a portion of their stimulus checks to local food banks, something to think about.
Interesting. And of course, another story that we continue to track is what's happening in the energy sector. Books will be written about what's happening with oil right now. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.